Do we want to get started?
Yeah, I think we do.
Are you using the open office form of...
Yeah, this is all open office.
Okay.
Sasha, are you going to moderate also? Please, what is that? You just want to just go in? Yeah.
You might need a moderator. But if you want to let me know, like, how long should I speak for? Like 15 minutes?
What do we have until 11:15?
11:20.
So how about we'll do like 15 minutes each and then throw it open for questions?
Cool. So they just let me know when we got like 5 and 2, what you got down there.
Okay.
All right, so we're going to each speak for about 15 minutes or so, and then try to get as much time for people to, this is really a reverberated room, to ask questions and get some discussion going. My name is Sasha Meinrath. I'm with QIN, which is one of these open source groups. And I'm going to give a brief overview of community wireless networking for those that don't have the tech chops yet. And here's what I'm going to cover in 15 minutes, right? So this is going to be pretty quick. What are community wireless networks? What are the different technologies? I'm going to talk about QIN a little bit. We're going to talk about some of the social benefits, which is basically why we're doing this. Some radical alternatives, next steps, things that we can do as a community to, piss off NAB and RIAA. Some take-home messages, etc. But first, I really wanted to sort of contextualize this in terms of the history, in this case specifically in the United States, but really of community media. So you have newspapers, 1704, the first newspapers, right, which were pretty much zines. There was a guy who put together what his friends told him. Telegraph in the 1840s. Telephones. How many people here knew that in the 1900s, you had 40 to 50% of all telephones owned by the home rule movement? Local groups, municipalities, collectives owned 40 to 50% of all telephones in the United States and got wiped out by AT&T. Which refused interconnectivity between them on their backbone. And if you think this isn't relevant, I encourage you to take a look at the Brand X case right now before the Supreme Court, where local ISPs are attempting to get the incumbents to open up their backbone. And the incumbents are saying, no, we don't want to do this. It's unfair competition. If the incumbents win, we will have the exact same problem as we did about 100 years ago in telephones. And then radio. Of course, radio was pioneered by amateurs, so-called amateurs, people like us. And if you were at some of the things earlier, you realize how easy it is to set up radio. And it's the same is true of these technologies here. And then, of course, television, etc. And then today, broadband connectivity. So community wireless networks tend to be these small, locally based, non-incorporated, unincorporated. That means like a bunch of geeks in a living room. That's how we started. Hybrid partnerships between municipalities and companies, et cetera, et cetera. We tend to use a lot of off-the-shelf hardware. We're not like building new hardware to do this. We're looking at, you know, what's at Best Buy or Circuit City? What can we kludge together from what we can get online? That sort of stuff. And then we have this mission of supporting social and economic development, social and economic justice. Which differs, I think, from pretty much all for-profit-driven enterprises doing this sort of work, because they're only interested in economic stuff. With a moment's pause to say, oh yeah, social's good. So here's what most people are familiar with networking, right? Your home network, where you got a DSL line coming into a computer and maybe an access point at home. And what we're talking about building here is connecting homes together. So and here's where the cool animation that just got finished is. Hopefully. Let's see if we can do this. There we go.
Whoa.
Look at that. So you got your internet connection coming to your home computer, then going up onto the roof and connecting houses together. And what you're forming... Oh, come on. Wasn't that cool?
Yeah.
So you can see more of Pat's work in such video games as, I don't know, Slaughter and Mayhem 3 or something like that. But anyway, the idea is to make a community network, a local area network, where you can start doing all sorts of cool, high-speed connectivity applications, like video conferencing, like file sharing, like voice over IP, right, local telephone service, over the network itself. The big difference is that this is all free within the network. Let me move on. So again, let me take you through the different technologies for wireless. You got originally the wired networks, right, which date back to the 1840s and the telegraph. And they're still here. This is what the majority of all internet connectivity comes through. I say entrenched mainly because they are literally, but also if you go to Washington or state legislators, these are the powerful groups that are screwing over every single consumer in the United States today. We're paying more for worse services in the United States than pretty much any other industrialized nation on the planet.
And some, and some countries that don't have any type of industrialization.
Right. So, and I was talking about industrial countries, but he was saying that, you know, there's a lot of other countries that aren't industrialized, which is true. What's nice about these technologies is you can deploy them really easily, because, and I wish I'd brought some of the things, they're small, portable, very low power, easy to set up, and I'll show you some of the examples of what they look like in a bit. And quick and easy. This model, the hub and spoke model, is the way in which wireless, for the most part, is deployed today. You got a tall tower somewhere, and everything beams down to the different locations throughout your community. The towers have massive, expensive equipment on them, and the only reason really to do it this way, other than you can centralize things, is so that you can do billing. So the perfect example for this sort of wireless communications is cell phones. Right? I get charged to make a call up to the tower, somebody else gets charged to receive my call, and we can't communicate directly to each other. It doesn't make sense, but it does sure help the company to make sure that they can bill everyone for the time on the network. A mesh network is really about peer-to-peer. It's really about direct communications between different individuals. And because we're using speeds that are pretty fast, I mean, 11 megabit rate, 11 megabits for 802.11b54, right? If you compare that to, say, like your internet connection point, your DSL line, your cable modem, even a T1 line, this is an order of magnitude or more faster than these things. But it depends on if you're talking about bit rate versus throughput and all that. So let's just say it's a hell of a lot faster. closed networks, again, these proprietary systems, this is what Motorola, Tropos, Alverion for non-mesh stuff, but all these companies are coming out with, like the Microsoft business model, right? You buy my system, then you're stuck with my system forever and ever. We're advocates, QN, of open networks, open standards, open architectures. The idea being that you can interconnect people. You have a system that is open to innovation, development, and anyone else that wants to join onto the network. Static networks are ones where you set the routes that they follow, and then if you end up with, say, spring in a tree, like this literally happens all over the place, when the leaves come out, the line goes down, or in this case, a truck. In our case, we actually had a bus that broke our system. That would come by every half hour and knock down the line, and we weren't sure why, so we were out there. Versus dynamic networks, which will, this is what self-healing or so-called self-healing networks are, that automatically change the routes in which packets data is distributed to adapt to the surrounding environments. So here's queuing. We've got a pretty straightforward social justice kind of mission, right? Connect, develop, disseminate, implement. That's what we do. We've been doing this since 2000. You have to imagine back in 2000 talking about a community-wide mesh network was like, people thought we were crazy. Now it's like people just think we're a little off-kilter, which is, might be true. This is what, for the geeks in the crowd, this is what's inside Q. And I saw Evan, I'm like, oh, what? That's me. Like, this is what's inside queuing in terms of how we're building it. NetBSD based. These are the different protocols that we're using for routing and route prioritization. We're using it on x86 architectures. This just means like anything from, you know, a Pentium computer, single board computer that's x86 based. We're using off the shelf components like wireless access points, antennas you can get online for about $50 a piece, things of that sort. And finally, we're using Open Spectrum. So these three, you know, open source, open architecture, open spectrum, what I'm calling like the trifecta for this sort of development. And it's what differs from, I think, a lot of the community groups that are doing this from the proprietary systems that are out there. So here's me with a Pringles can antenna. How many people here have heard of the Pringles can antenna? A couple of you. You can basically build, and we build these things out of an old Pringles can. That little device that I'm holding will go into a Pringles can, and you can connect computers at over a mile away. It sounds really cool, and it is, except when you put them outside, which is, yeah. So, and it's also very directional, right? It's only beaming in one specific location. We eventually went with an omnidirectional, which broadcasts in all directions. Here's a recycled computer node. One of the things that differentiates QIN from a lot of the systems that are out there is we have basically a CD bootable software implementation. You can throw it into a computer, turn it on, and it automates everything else. Right? So if I had two computers right now, right here, with wireless cards, I could turn them on with the CD and the CD-ROM drive, boot off of that thing, and it would figure out, oh, there's another node here, let me load up the operating system, the software, let me get all the routes set, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
Any wireless card?
No. There's about half a dozen supported wireless cards. The wireless card manufacturers don't make drivers for NetBSD for the most part and don't want to. And so we're actually developing the drivers to run the wireless cards under this operating system.
Cool.
It's a big pain in the ass.
Oh.
Pardon? Yes. Yeah, and we wrote a paper about this that The Economist picked up and ran with. There was an Economist story about how they're closing off this thing. There's two companies that control like 80% of the wireless chipsets in the world. This is like, you know, Mac and Microsoft, but it's hidden from public view. No one knows about this. So here's an ammo can router. Back in 2000, 2001, we were like, we're going to put these computers outside, and there really wasn't equipment widely available that would do this. So we built outdoor computers. This is a fully functioning routing computer built out of an ammo can, a couple of pieces of plexiglass, and one hell of a lot of work from our technical lead, Dave Young. This is where we are today. We have a metrics node. This is a group out of Seattle, old wireless sort of veterans that were sick and tired of not having kits that you could put together very easily. This is about the size of five CDs stacked together and does everything. It's pretty small, and these are the nodes that are ready to be installed. These would go up onto a roof, be attached to a chimney, with what's called a chimney mount. You can get it Radio Shack for $20. And here I am on top of a roof. So we're like, you know, programmers in the IT world by day, working on this at night and climbing around on roofs on the weekend. It's a lot of fun, usually. This is Brian Cribbs, one of our core developers with our software proving ground. This is our test bed, which is a bunch of these little boards put together. This is where we actually do testing of the computer software before we put it out into the community. We would probably rather people buy directly from the people that we buy from.
Oh, okay. No, it's not too difficult to go out and purchase.
Right. Yeah, it was very weird. I was at Wi-Fi Planet before this, which is a big vendor smorgasbord smooze fest. And like everyone that speaks tries to sell you stuff. And I got up there and like, so yeah, I don't want to sell you anything. We give away our software for free, and I want you to buy equipment from other people. And like the audience was like, who is this guy? This is the Shambana.net infrastructure. I'm going to run out of time, so I'll go real quick as to why we're doing that. This is our network 6 months ago now, maybe a little bit more. It's now doubled in size. And if you look where it says Lincoln Square, see there's like a little bit of a hole in there, and that's because the city of Urbana has decided to build a wireless downtown. So 40 square blocks, wireless connectivity for free, and the total cost is going to be $18,600, which may sound like a lot. But if you know anything about what communities are spending, they're spending hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, on proprietary systems. Seriously, hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars for proprietary systems. So that's Shambana.net infrastructure. Pardon? This is 40. Yeah. So the social benefits of this, I think, are pretty numerous. And one of the reasons for the Shambana.net infrastructure, those two guys like pulled away in the basement there, is that we want to integrate a lot of these applications into the wireless system. So imagine ubiquitous, high-speed, free broadband connectivity and applications. That's what we're building today. Here's some smart alternatives, what are labeled as radical or insane by the telecom incumbents, as to what we can be doing with these technologies that we don't do today with our internet service provision, right? All ISPs are trying to get you to connect to the internet, but aren't trying to get you to connect to your neighbors. And why is that? Like, we know that radio is a good idea, and local radio stations are a good idea. We really like, you know, our local public access television stations. We really like our local newspapers and zines and whatever else. But we're trying to buy a system that's overpriced and doesn't give us direct access to each other. Here's some take-home messages from what I've been talking about very briefly thus far. Implement more of these things. Right now, the movement is exploding onto the national scene, right? And because of that, we're fighting massive battles at the state levels all over the place. And I've got another talk that I could give for the next hour about that. And you got people like in D.C. who are fighting this thing. Actually, we've got one person here from Free Press. They've actually been fantastic at fighting the policy battles to prevent us from making it literally illegal, right? Literally illegal to build these systems as a municipality. It would be illegal to build this if the telecom incumbents had their way. Strengthening this coalition of developers, implementers, basically the folks here, and then a bunch of the folks out there all coming together and saying, hey, this needs to be built. It's better services for cheaper prices. Repealing these laws that have already been passed. There's now 14 states with anti-competition laws. And then passing new regulations that are actually going to support technological innovation. It amazes me how little the politicians and the policymakers know about these technologies. And yet they're the ones setting the policy. So in some ways, we have to be there educating them. Because frankly, they get all their information from the telecom incumbents, and what the telecom incumbents say is bullshit. So finally, some conclusions here. These services are faster and they're cheaper than what you're getting today, what you're paying for today. They're accessible and they're viable right now. Like, you could go out and build these things. I think Paul will talk about one of those. And then what we can do with these things is really fairly unlimited, right? No one thought an open-source, open-architecture system like the internet, right, would explode like it has. And yet we're throwing out like that great idea and project and doing something completely different with proprietary wireless, which is stupid. Like, we really should open that up. So here's where you can get some more information if you're interested in this. And this last one here, communityinternet.us, is going to have a hell of a lot of really accessible, sort of the non-technical information for people that want to sort of get their feet wet with these technologies. Not just wireless, but a bunch of different sort of broadband technologies and services. CWireless.net is the project page for my group. And then Free Press has a bunch of information on their site, on the community internet, about what's happening at the state and national levels. And it's definitely worth taking a look just to see how corrupt politicians are right now. There's a national bill that's pending right now. So with that, I think we can swap it over there. Cool. I hope I didn't go too over.
No problem.
No, it's great.
Plug it
into
here?
Yeah, to me, actually. Exactly.
You can plug it into your computer.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Everything's backed up on here, so.
Hooray.
Cool. Cool. And we'll do a quick... Yep. And so we're good. So I'm going to talk a little bit about BCT Partners. BCT Partners, this is a great group that I do work for. I used to be full-time senior consultant, research associate there. Now I'm actually doing more of the work that Sasha was talking about in terms of keeping telecom companies at bay. I run the Media Justice Fund at the Funding Exchange. But I also do some consulting work at BCT, and I do my own research at the New School as a part of my PhD program, looking at issues of the digital divide, trying to redress all these, trying to triangulate these issues and bring them all together in a cogent dialogue. So I'm going to talk a little bit about underserved communities. Those are the communities that happen to be black and brown, often working class and low income. And it's a different approach to the technology because the technology is embedded in structural barriers that may include racism, economic racism, economic marginalization. And this happens in urban areas, rural areas, ethnic enclaves where people may speak English as a second language. And so the technology is seen as a tool to help address some of these structural issues. And so the community comes to the technology in a different way than perhaps some other models that are operative. Okay, boom.
That was fast.
Oh, well, I'm done. Let's go back. Hold on. Let's do this. Oh, no wonder. Cool. And so this is what I'm going to talk about, some of the legislative and technological trends, the community wireless projects that we do that have been done and continue to do at BCT from the ground up. BCT is a firm that's really committed to looking at communities as stakeholders in this technological position. And BCT is run by a relatively small group of young people who are really interested in engaging in underserved communities with some creative solutions. Then I'll talk about the legislative. So some of these, like high-speed internet access in low-income housing. So while the Bush administration has basically cut a lot of the programs, at the state level what we've seen is a lot of development dollars for low-income housing tax credits, which would really go to the developers. Now embedded in those financial structures are dollars for high-speed internet access. Yet a lot of the developers don't necessarily have an understanding of what that means in some of these underserved communities. BCT tries to fill that gap and provide an opportunity for the community residents who live in these affordable housing complex to come to the table as stakeholders, saying what they need from the technology to help address some of the issues in their community. I'm going to run through this and give you high level. We could actually get into a discussion because I'm more interested in what the questions are than presenting information that way. So 29 states have passed this legislation, which is the low-income housing tax credit that includes high-speed internet access as a part of new developments and retrofitting old developments of affordable housing, which actually is in direct contrast to the legislative trends of bans on municipal wireless. And you ask, well, how does this work? You know, what you have is a core of lobbyists. You have a core of lobbyists for state contractors who are really after those AAA bond ratings that a lot of municipalities have. And then you have large telco companies like SBC, Verizon, who are after the dollars for the infrastructure on telecom. And they're actually competing with each other in terms of who's going to be able to win. And so it's a very good time for activists to be involved in this debate and actually to get boned up. As Sasha has already talked about, many state legislators, even federal legislators, have no idea what the implications are. Even their staffs who are supposed to have the technical training to be able to articulate this to the member don't even have an appreciation for what it means and certainly don't have an appreciation for what it means in under-resourced communities. So to be able to articulate in a position that brings these communities to the table in a meaningful way is a very great opportunity that we're looking forward to taking on. So these are some of the trends, and I'm not going to get into a lot of the background in the tech stuff because I'm actually a policy person. The tech stuff I leave to the techies who actually work. But we work in tandem. We have a policy research side and a tech side. I actually, when I'm there, sit with the techies just so I can have a better understanding of what gigahertz really mean, because it doesn't really mean anything to me, other than understanding what the technology is capable to do and what the bans in the pending legislation actually prohibit and what that means in terms of the opportunities to solve problems in these communities and what that really means. So excuse me if I'm going a little bit fast. I just want to get us through this dialogue and actually hear from you. So in a lot of these communities, we have hardwire programs, we have wireless hotspots, and then we have what, and oftentimes this wired and wireless community networks in order to retrofit a lot of the older housing stock. Particularly, I'll talk about a project that we did up in the Bronx that was in the New York Times around trying to retrofit some of these older buildings when you have, you know, these cement blocks buildings built in the 1920s when buildings were actually really built now. And so I'll try to run through some of these, but I wanted to talk about some of the work that we've done in and I continue to do in the Northeast. So Kentfield State's affordable housing complex in Roxbury that was like at the beginning. Dr. Randall Pinkett, who's the CEO of BCT, actually did a lot of this work for his dissertation. In terms of, this is Camden, a new housing development where they were, they had a CTC inside, which is a community technology center, which was the hub where a lot of the affordable housing residents were able to go access information about technology. They also had computers in their home, but this was a central place for them to come, get information, upload information, and exchange information in an offline setting. And there's a key component to BCT's work, which is you can have online if you like, and that's a great thing. But if there's no offline organizing that goes along with that, it doesn't really have a lot of import for under-resourced communities in particular, but I would say across all types of activism and organizing. And so this is what was actually happening. So residents were able to get on, load up information. They were able to have personal interactions, create their own content, have discussions about what was going on in the community, synchronous and asynchronous communication that provided them the opportunity to really be engaged in local, national, and state issues, have a dialogue about that, and really try to come to some type of individual and communal expression of what that really means in terms of expressing their interests. This is some of the work. O'Brien was one of the people who also worked with Randall on this project, who did his dissertation on looking at African American women who were living in this affordable housing complex and documenting their empowerment process, how they were using this technology to come off of welfare rolls, to be engaged in public benefits and get health care while even trying to find gainful employment. Looking at the, we did work in Philadelphia and United Way, trying to leverage a lot of the comprehensive CBOs that were working there and trying to share information. As you may know, since Philly is the first city, one of the first cities to try to provide comprehensive municipal wireless, which then actually had the state legislature go and tried to ban municipal wireless throughout the state. They were very, unfortunately, they were successful, but Philly was grandfathered in. Philly gets to ramp up their wireless provision, and hopefully we'll get the success in Philadelphia will provide an opportunity to actually repeal that state legislation, and maybe even give us some federal legislation that would kind of keep a check on it. I'm going to get past, well, Sasha talked a little bit about what that meant, a lot of the nuts and bolts. And this is some of the configurations for the work that was done in the United Way. So you had these computers at all these different locations, and there was some were doing line of sight. Now, let me be clear. I do policy. I am not a techie. But I sit with but I play techie on stage sometimes. And so some of the work we were doing were like line of sight stuff. So I was actually on the roof of some of these buildings, like, okay, what does this really mean? Looking at the antennas and actually being able to shoot and trying to distinguish between a mesh network and things that were basically line of sight. So that means if you could see it, then you could shoot wireless to it. That's the easiest way for me to explain it. And so what we had was the One Economy Corporation, which is, you know, most famous for the Beehive, which is local content, provides a lot of socio-cultural relevant content for people who are living in these areas. They're able to access information, be distributors of that content, and actually producers of that content. So this is a project we did up in the Bronx that got a lot of coverage in New York City in terms of providing revitalization and as part of an economic development package and a part of a self-sufficiency package, which is a part of this contracted welfare state. And so we were looking for some opportunities to really go out and engage people in the community around what this meant. We hosted focus groups. We got some community participation. And this is kind of what it looked like in terms of the cost. Cool, I got about 5 minutes. In terms of providing the internet service. And what this meant is basically the chart of paying for it. We can come back to that issue. This is one of those buildings that was tough in order to basically get through that brick and mortar. So we were able to go on top of the buildings and spray wireless, and then in some places had to retrofit and go in through and drill. Like, you know, I was sitting there watching people like drill through this mortar in order to hardwire the building, in order to, because the density of the building just would not provide the wireless connection. And this is a T1 line that they were paying for, like $700 a month, and so they were only paying $7. The property owner was only paying $7 per month for the 100 units. And this is the building up in the Bronx that was actually done. I'm sure a lot of people right now are asking this, can we do central air conditioning the same way for the same cheaper cost? And this is a project that I was a part of, the Madison Park Development Corporation, which has a CTC. And the workers there were actually, as a part of the CTC, again, which is this community technology center, they were providing training, A-plus training and technical training, and they were taking a Cisco system and basically with their routers and 100 cards were building their own system in Roxbury. And we actually brought some people to Sasha's event in last summer who got some good training and went back and trained some of the trainers and shared the information around what this meant. And so they entered into partnership with the Urban League, who was interested in doing this wireless project, and actually came into partnership with the public library, who had a T1 line, the metro system that wanted to provide kiosk and also provide wireless provision on the buses that would go around and actually spray wireless as the buses went through the neighborhoods. This is a really progressive idea, because we're not clear under E-rate if a public library can share its T1 line and its discount with CBOs. And so we kind of didn't wait to ask permission. We just kind of were moving this project along to get it done, and we're hopeful that this become a model that's replicable, and even if it's not, and if we're challenged, to be able to go to court and actually win. And so what are some of the pending questions? You know, internet service provision, is it municipal versus private firms? Because, as Sasha pointed out, this is proprietary, most of this for nonprofit organizations. And we're hoping to get the sustainability issue is large for these. Well, oftentimes it's the local. I have 2 minutes. So oftentimes it's the telecom companies, because we're talking about under-resourced communities and they don't necessarily have all the tech work. So like Cisco Systems comes in, they get a Cisco system. Great. Now we have a customer base for which you can't really go anywhere once you've already done it. You have Verizon, who is saying, okay, yeah, we can provide, you know, the opportunity for you to buy into what we want you, which is why the E-rate program becomes very important in terms of sustainability and managing this for a lot of under-resourced CBOs, community-based organizations that are already doing this. So what does that wireless configuration look like? Will it be open source? Will it be, you know, the WiMAX technology that's proprietary? Will it be Wi-Fi? Or, you know, what next generation technology will we see come down? And what would that mean for under-resourced communities that are already behind in terms of technology and their access to technology? The backbone and infrastructure that Sasha talked about, who owns it? Who has to pay for it? And if so, why and how? Will the state step in and see itself as a guarantor of access for these communities to the World Wide Web and to the economic and social opportunities that come with that connection? And really, another issue that Sasha talked about, which is community content and distribution. These communities have the information. They have the answers to the problems that they're seeking to solve. But can they share that? Can they share what's replicable and what's working in Boston, which with maybe housing rights in Philadelphia, as we see gentrification issues arise in a lot of these communities? Will they be able to share their organizing and the content that's produced there as a way to galvanize activists? And what does that mean in terms of public and private ownership? And so this is just a few of the questions. And so that wraps me up. I hope I got in my 15 minutes. Thanks.
Okay, let's do this one.
Still up?
Hooray. So,
gotcha.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Paul Smith. I'm with the Center for Neighborhood Technology in Chicago, and I'm really glad to be here and address you, talk about our community wireless project that we've started and are operating in a number of communities in Illinois. I think Sasha and Antoine have touched on a lot of what are the big picture issues and what are people doing with community wireless right now. And what I'm going to do is tell you a little bit about a specific project that we're doing and get into a little bit of the nitty-gritty. What does it look like to actually build one of these networks? What are some of the challenges that come up, political and social and technological? And just give you sort of a taste of what does it really mean to build a sort of medium-sized community network. Just to give you a little bit of a background, CNT is a nonprofit organization that typically does energy efficiency work, transportation policy, smart growth issues, and like land use planning, watershed analysis, that sort of stuff. We didn't really do a lot of like on the ground activism or direct contact. A lot of our work is regionally based. So when Wi-Fi came along in 1999, we saw that as a really interesting opportunity to address what we saw as a looming problem of information access. And so we started playing around with that a little bit and, what could we really get out of it? And what we saw was that the technology just wasn't sufficiently advanced for doing this kind of community wireless at the time, but we didn't give up on it, and we kept playing and kept lobbying for opportunities to sort of see how that would develop. And it so happens that the money that we got for this project we secured before we had any idea, how we were actually going to do it. And just serendipity happened that we found QWIN, and we immediately saw this is exactly what we need to do. This is exactly the technology, the right time to sort of get over this hurdle. So everything sort of fell into place, and what happened was we secured some money from the Department of Commerce. Some of you may have heard of the Technology Opportunities Program, which has now been zeroed out, unfortunately. Some state monies that match that, and also some private foundation money. So with that in mind, we took our objective was to look at four underserved communities in Illinois, two in Chicago, one in suburban Cook County, and one in downstate Illinois, a rural community. And the idea was that there's a digital divide that's not just about computers any longer. It's now about access to broadband and all of the economic development opportunities and advantages that go along with that. So let me just page through a couple of these slides real quick. So we call our project everybody else calls the whole thing community wireless networking, and we were savvy enough to call it wireless community networking. It's a pilot project, so what this means is we're sort of experimenting with the implementation of the technology and our model of deployment and partnerships with community organizations to see, can we build sustainable large-scale, community-owned and operated networks. It's about bringing broadband to the home, so a lot of community wireless projects are doing that. They're, you know, low-income housing and that sort of thing. And it's also, you know, building hotspots, but we're primarily about building neighborhood-wide networks where you're using the computer, you're using the broadband connection on a computer in your home. And the four communities we selected were North Lawndale, Pilsen. Both of these are neighborhoods in Chicago. Elgin's the suburban county I was talking about, or community, and West Frankfort. And I bracketed West Frankfort because, for all intents and purposes, they are doing their own thing. They didn't get any of the federal money. It doesn't matter. They're not really part of our the way we're doing things in Chicago. And so the whole objective here is to sort of not only like actually serve 250 households in each of these communities and, you know, provide real benefit to these families, but to come up with like a business plan. And I use scare quotes there because this isn't we're a nonprofit. This isn't a for-profit enterprise by any stretch of the imagination. This is about creating a sustainable community-owned enterprise. And there may be for-profit elements to that. There may be other sorts of interesting entrepreneurial things that come along with that. But we want to see, like, how can community groups really how can you build these things at scale? We talked about CNT. That's the funding we got. So our current status, we went officially online last summer, and we have about 50 nodes, and the nodes that I'm referring to are the very same that Sasha described earlier, the metrics nodes. These are rooftop nodes, and we have approximately 75 households online right now. And I say approximately to both of those because there was a flurry of activity this week, some of which I missed. And hopefully we're going to double these numbers by the end of the summer. And these numbers are just strictly for Lawndale and Pilsen. We actually haven't done anything in Elgin yet. So a little bit of background about North Lawndale. It's a neighborhood on the west side of Chicago. It's predominantly black, one of the poorest communities in Chicago. And it also has one of the highest ex-offender populations in the country, I believe. So there's tremendous economic obstacles and adversity in that community. And it's also beginning to feel the creep of gentrification. This is a look down on not really the heart of Lawndale, but a part of it called Homan Square. And Homan Square is a sort of an experimental subpart of the Lawndale community. And the building, the sort of flat building you see to the center left there, is the Homan Square Community Center. And they provide health care and daycare services, and also they have a community technology center. And it's sort of a central place for people in the neighborhood. And to the right there, you see some mixed-income housing that's brand new, that's developed by the foundation that built Homan Square. But really, Lawndale is much denser than this photo indicates. So we decided in each of the communities that we're operating in to partner with a community organization to be the sort of central point of focus for the project. So they're going to provide the outreach and publicity. So they're going to let everyone know that, hey, this is a thing that is coming, and would you, you know, like to be a part of it, shape it, so forth, and through their existing programs, and then training so that users would be able to effectively take advantage of the service, and to be sort of ongoing, like, go-to people for all sorts of issues. So a couple of fun slides here. This is the Homan Square is built on the grounds of the old Sears Roebuck catalog plant, and this at the time it was in existed, it was one of the largest industrial buildings in the world, if not the. And this the original Sears Tower and it's 16 stories, and it still exists, and it was kept even though the rest of the building was torn down in the 80s. And it's sort of, you can see it from everywhere, all over the city, and it's a pretty interesting icon of the economic past and potential future of the community. And the reason I have it here is that we put a number of our Wi-Fi radios in the very top there. And actually, this is a photo that we just found recently. We're pretty excited about. This is a shot, an aerial shot of the Roebuck catalog plant. So you can see the tower there in the very center. And then that enormous building is the old catalog plant. That's where Home and Square is built on top of right now. Actually had their own power generation plant next door. This is one of the denizens of the Sears Tower. There's a pair of falcons that live in the very... they like to perch and hunt from the top, and they also like to remind us that they're boss when we go up there to work. So anyway, so what did we do to build this wireless network? Well, we identified Home and Square and NTRC, which is the CTC, in the community center. We initially arranged for them to be providing some connection to the internet, and that's just through a retail service right now, but we're looking to move that into something that's more sustainable and higher bandwidth in the long term. And then through surveys, they reached out to their constituents, the people that they already serve, and to say, sort of alert them about the project. And then C&T is sort of fortunate that we have some GIS resources, and we were able to sort of, okay, now that we've got these surveys, how can we, you know, and there's more demand than there is supply, so how do we identify sort of strategically, and from a physical layout point of view, these are, you know, usually single-family homes or apartment buildings, the best way to build out the network. And then the other way you sort of winnow that down is through the intangibles, and usually that's has to do with the what the community partner is telling us, like these are the families that need this the most, or this family is very enthusiastic, so forth and so on. There's some political pressure there too that you sort of factor in, and then you get sort of a list of people to get connected. And then the idea is that you need to, when you're building a wireless network, you need to do it strategically so that you can ensure coverage, because the technology we're talking about has limitations and signal degradation, all these problems, and you want to do it in a way that ensures that there aren't sort of islands of coverage where people aren't connected. I'll get in maybe a little more into that in a minute. So what are some of the things you have to think about when you're getting a household online? First, this is sort of a fuzzy area, but getting permission. Now, you know, if you want satellite or cable, you don't have to ask permission. It's part of the law of your landlord or the property owner to get that installed. So, but we actually do ask permission because we want to ensure that there's a sense of good faith effort with the project and all of the landowners in the community. We have an agreement that sort of outlines, like, these are the terms of use, and you know, pretty standard stuff, like that just indemnifies the community center against any potential misuse, but also sort of lets the participant know what they can expect and what sort of rights they have and what things are guaranteed to them. And then one thing I haven't mentioned yet about North Lawndale, but it's approximately 50% of the households, or we actually think it's significantly higher than that, but don't have a computer, never owned a computer. So we have managed to secure donations of laptops and PCs, and they're usually pretty nice. They're Pentium 3s or higher from corporations because, you know, they're coming off lease and they're just a few years old, but they have no need for them, and disposal is a big problem. So actually, if you ask around, getting donated computers is, you know, if you apply yourself, you can find a lot of them. So we actually refurbish them, or we set them up with a new operating system, and then, you know, whatever sort of configuration we is that fits the project, and we get them out the door. And then you need to do a site survey, so somebody has to go out and actually physically inspect the property just to see, you know, is this feasible? Is this practical? Like, are we actually going to connect anyone? Is there a line of sight to another node? Is there, you know, some big obstruction? Is there, you know, what? Where's the actual computer going to go, and can we get a Ethernet cable to it? And then scheduling, just arranging a time for the install, and then the install itself is you're going to send at least two people out, and it's going to take about an hour to two, typically, we've found, and you're going to climb up on the roof, you're going to drill a hole to get this Ethernet cable inside, which also provides power to the node, and ultimately can connect the computer. And then any follow-up, so just making sure that, you know, is the service working for you? Are you happy? Are there any issues? Viruses, spyware, so forth and so on. And, oh, great. My links to my photos are broken. We'll open those in a second. So one of the things we've done is we've hosted node building parties. So you know, sort of a problem like, okay, there's all this equipment, and these nodes are actually a kit that you assemble, and it's non-trivial. It takes like an hour or so to put them together. Like, okay, you know, what do we do about that? Well, you know, there's also this sense like, you know, we're not just swooping in here and saying, here's your technology and leaving. This is about creating community ownership. So we have hosted these node building parties, and they're usually in the community center. We've had some at CNT, some in some of the other community organizations that have decided to participate in the program. And we get the nodes, the kits, and everybody from the community comes out, and you put them together, and you screw them together, and you crimp Cat 5, and it's a lot of fun. And it surprisingly, people pick it up pretty quick, and they're not intimidated by it. By, you know, like, it's amazing to see how many people have taken to crimping Cat 5, which is, you know, I think one of the most annoying things about working with computers. But it's pretty remarkable. So I'm going over long here. Oh, here's a photo of one of these node building parties. So I'm just going to wrap up by saying there's a lot that I didn't cover. I should have winnowed it down a bit here, but there are challenges, obviously, for organizations like CNT. We're largely white, middle class. We're working in these low-income communities. Like, there's, you know, obviously a big disparity in terms of expectations and that sort of thing. So just being cognizant of that, using your community partner is really your interface to the community. Some other issues about privacy and you know, making sure that you're hearing from the community when you're designing the network and putting it together and providing services. A lot of inter-community organization politics, especially in Lawndale, which has had a history of organizations coming in from the outside and trying to tinker with the mechanics of it. So, and then there are turf battles, you know, even from the organizations that have been there a long time. Something to just, you know, make sure you find out from your community partner. And, okay. So if you're going to do this, like, what are the questions you need to ask yourself? And I have, actually, there's probably like five slides of questions here. You know, you want to ask yourself this. I'll wrap this up. But you want to ask, how serious are you? Is this just an experiment, or is this something that you're going to get into and do for the long haul? How many people do you anticipate you're going to serve? is this a one-year thing, a five-year thing, a 10-year thing? Do you want to be an ISP and all that it entails with legal ramifications to support, to just the burden of providing the service? Do we have insurance when you're doing installs? You need to be insured and bonded. You know, what services does your community need? Obviously, is a huge one. What are the other institutions that can provide assistance? Training, impacting your existing organization, this is going to be a big burden for you if you're going to suddenly take on all these customers and like how do you support them? Do you have a fundraising strategy? How are you going to make this sustainable? Time to wrap up. Okay.
Yeah, what happened?
Well, we don't know that yet, actually, because we're sort of like throwing supply at the demand right now.
But right now, the QID project is completely swamped with organizations and municipalities and cities and now companies that all want to like check out our software, use it, implement it, experiment with it. So in terms of that sort of demand, we've sort of completely maxed out like our staff.
And we have a different, you know, I mean, some of the work that that BCT does and that I do with them is a little bit different because we started with 100 network cards in Madison Park. So the question is, who gets that technology in the affordable housing complex, and what does that mean in terms of getting buy-in from everyone else who lives in that complex to be patient enough to wait for them to have access? So, I mean, all these questions. And then you have, you know, neighboring CDCs that want to get in on it. I mean, it just becomes, you know, and this is the problem. I think this is the larger issue. Why should people have to wait? And this is the conversation that becomes a good organizing tool, right? Why is it that they have to wait for something that they should already have access to when the state, the city, the federal government should be ensuring that they already have it? It's a great organizing tool to get people pissed off and upset about what they should have already and shouldn't be paying a lot for, which is already piss poor that we've already talked about. And they own it. They should.
If you look at like a lot of other countries that have been a lot more aggressive in deploying these things, you go to like Japan or South Korea, where they have near universal penetration, and where they're paying things like I think it's $9 a month for an 8 megabit symmetric line, which is
more than you would ever need.
Yeah, it's like.
Is everybody just paying for it out of their taxes or whatever?
No, that's the actual cost. What we pay for is like marketing, and what we pay for is like schlock. I mean, it's just really horrible. But yeah, you
push. Do you know about the Verizon's FTTP service? And do you have any thoughts about the coolness of that application? Or sounds awesome.
Yeah, I have a lot of reservations of anything coming out of that.
Can I make a comment on it? It's what? Fiber to the home we're talking about.
So this is like, this would be if you did fiber optic cable to every home in a community.
That you don't need.
So you had like gigabit and it's connectivity. It's a big issue. We could talk more maybe after this.
One comment I'll make is that it's just never, ever going to come to these low-income communities. It's just too expensive to do this last-mile deployment, and that's why wireless is so attractive. You just hop over the wire.
And not only does it not... It's not so expensive. I just don't think they don't see it as a part of their marketing strategy. Absolutely. It's not that expensive. They just don't see it as a part of
their
marketing
strategy. Well, I mean, you don't have to do that.
I don't even, like, digital cable hasn't come to us yet. Optimum Online, you know, bullshits and loans. Oh, we have digital cable for everybody, the cable for everybody. I'm in, like, a pretty narrow affluent part of the world, like, 8% of homes. Brand new housing starts and everything. They don't have digital cable yet. We still have all the analog cable. We can't even get like, you know, the same thing. So Verizon's not going to provide any fiber optic to us anytime soon. So this is a possible solution.
And when they do, they're going to charge you out the ass.
Yeah. There's several folks got their hands up. So
uh-huh.
Depends on what system you use. The queue in the network will share any bandwidth that it has anywhere on the network. So you could have a DSL line, a T1.
I have a DSL line, and I have Linksys wireless in the building itself.
Right. So literally, you could take this DSL line, assuming that it's okay with your user agreement, right? I don't want to get you into trouble with that.
Which is probably is not.
But, right. But, you know, you can literally take that thing, and instead of plugging it into, say, you know, just your computer or just your wireless access point, you would plug it into a QN node and then bounce it over to the next houses down. So you'd be paying exactly the same. You'd just be providing services for other folks. And that's what we do in our community. The only lines we're using are ones that have been donated to the project. So we're paying zero for bandwidth.
Well, what we've talked already, but she provides social services and there's a media literacy program that she wants to do. And so what I'm saying is look for that uncommon partner. Is there a public library? Is there a school there? I would say find out what that agreement could look like in terms of hooking up into their T1 line, because they already have the infrastructure, and I'm sure they're probably not using it and could share it in a way that would be, I mean, totally awesome. I know the area. She's talking about Valdosta, Georgia, and I know what that area looks like. And so in terms of what those partnerships look like, it's an opportunity to do it before it's prohibited.
You'll be surprised, too. Small businesses are more than willing to donate excess bandwidth after 5 o'clock when they shut down, too. So there's a lot of ways to peer.
QN is everyone behind that?
Pardon?
Is everyone behind that with QN?
Is everyone behind that?
NAT.
No.
Explain what NAT is just for everyone who's in.
It's like a big internet connection.
The long answer is a lot more complicated in that.
It's fully routed, the QN network. It's private addresses, but there's no NAT unless you have NAT at the gateway level.
And eventually, you want to move to IPv6, which it also routes right now, and have the entire network fully addressable from inside and outside the network. But that's probably more technical than we need to go. The gentleman over here had his hand up. No. Didn't you have a question?
Well, I have thoughts, but I
don't
know
if
it's not so often.
That
work? Yeah. I don't know if you need this. Anyway, I've been, this is kind of very interesting because I've been watching from some of the Linux groups that I'm aware of the whole emergence of the idea of skipping the last mile and coming free from the wired networks that are totally controlled by, as you mentioned, large corporations. The entire society has been controlled in the same manner, not only the telephone, but TV. I mean, for the entire history of the 19th century, 20th century, the artists and creators have had very little access, very little direct access to the mediums that affect us. You know, that we share information in this democracy, and the last opportunity. Well, there have been opportunities all the way along. Cable Access Corporation, which is where our community arts organization does a cable program, has been minimally supported. To the point that all of the all of the programming that most people absorb is produced by a few companies, whereas the vast number of artists available to produce programming have been limited.
Can I jump in for a second?
It's an opportunity to break through all that, but maybe not. You know, maybe we're just living in a small chunk of time where the internet is open temporarily until they can put stops in. You know? So to me, this wire. The obvious evidence of their move for control is in those legislative initiatives that you mentioned, to try to prevent municipalities and God forbid that individuals could actually run a local network, wireless network.
Well, there's definitely a reason why activists are building these networks, but I think
Well, you were talking about cable television. There's interesting work going on in Lawndale right now with public access cable. It's a natural media. They're natural producers for this new community wireless media. You're absolutely right. Like, there's interesting ownership and access issues here, and you can take advantage of existing arts and all sorts of already produced media.
Well, and let me disagree just a little bit, because I think it's important for the dialogue, because you have some communities who don't have cable access channels, and where they do have cable access channels, it's not readily accessible to everyone who lives in the community. So I think it becomes a much more complicated discussion in terms of one, producing content, and then distribution of that content. And I think that's an important conversation to have.
Absolutely.
And it's, I think, an important conversation to have that many of the cable franchise agreements are now being backdoor dealed between cable companies and telecom companies, you know, in the convergence to be moved to the state level, where they would no longer have these obligations to provide you with the cable access that you have now under your cable franchise agreement. So it becomes a much more nuanced and complicated argument, and so activists must, one, rethink even the art and the activism that they do and put it into this digital context, and then arm themselves with the information of policy to be able to, one, position the work that they do and the livelihood that they want to have, and in terms of that distribution also. So it becomes a much more nuanced and complicated discussion.
Biological effects. I've gotten this question a lot more, actually, in previous years than we have today. There have been no long-term studies of the effects of this electromagnetic radiation, period, just because it hasn't been around in these levels so far. The good news is that your cell phones are an order of magnitude more powerful than these devices. So if we're going to get fried, it's going to happen from the cell phones, not from the wireless.
Yeah, usually you have these wireless devices, you know, they're up on the roof, or they're not, like, by your body organs, and so it falls off rather quickly over distance.
But I think it is really interesting in that there, you know, there's just no long-term study. Like, what happens when you're exposed to this for 50 years? We don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, so I was just going to ask a couple of really quick questions as to the information on a community that definitely can use this. There's drug centers, community service centers that, like, say, the university work area on that. One question is, so we don't have to go through a ton of URLs and stuff like that. Do you have resources we can get in the either a paper format or in, like, the USB plug-in format that we can copy and take with us that will have, like, information like vendors, information like parts of your PowerPoint presentations that are questions that I would have to take with me in order to go to my community representatives and actually get on the table and start making this kind of thing happen? And do you have those kind of materials? What's the easiest way to get those kind of materials?
The slide that I put up right at the end, do you want me to...
Well, Free Press is a good site to look at for some of the legislative stuff, too. A lot of resources there. Freepress.net, right?
The CU Wireless Project has a ton of documentation on its website, just in terms of what the different devices are and things of that sort. And then the communityinternet.us site. I'll just put up that last slide that I had up there.
And BCT Partners is actually in Newark on NJIT's campus. And yeah. So, and I would say a lot of the learning that we're talking about is coming out of CTCNet. And they have a lot of those documents, and BCT has those documents, so it's... Mm-hmm.
And I tend to put all my publications up on my blog, where I also do a lot of telecom policy analysis. And all the stuff that I produce is all Creative Commons licensed, so people should feel free to take and use as needed. Yeah.
Can you talk about
I think you were waiting.
People with the mic.
I just have a question, sort of about like the barriers of like literacy and how, you know, because to me, like, I feel very intimidated, but at the same time, I feel like maybe part of a category of people that might be able to somewhat kind of like understand both sides of the, you know what I mean? Like, be a bridge somewhat. So as far as like people that you have working on those projects, like what are challenges that they have with that?
Well, definitely we need more folks like you who can help bridge this. And I think a tremendous amount of energy right now is being spent by telecom incumbents to convince everyone that this is a really complicated technology best left to the experts. Like, their big thing is, like, reliability is now their big thing. They want you to believe that this is a really complicated technology and not something where you can, like, if you can burn a music CD, you can set up your own telecommunications infrastructure, right? Like, that's not what they want you to know. And so I think a lot of it is just because Q and these groups, like, we don't have marketing departments that are out there pulling out full-page ads in the New York Times and stuff like that. So the only way people learn about this is when they talk to you because you happen to be at this session, or they, like, stumble across the website and stuff. But this is, like, this sort of viral communications is how the information that, in fact, like, if you can plug in a telephone, you can build a telecommunication system, that's how that's going to spread. And it's vital. I mean, this is something that, like, you don't have to have a comp sci, well, I don't even have a comp sci degree. Like, you don't have to be, like, an expert technician to do. It's, you know, at the most complicated, like, it's like building a simple Lego ship, you know? I mean, this is pretty straightforward stuff.
In terms of dealing with communities that, one, that don't speak English as a first language, and in a lot of communities, we know in Dearborn, where there's a large Arab population, in terms of a lot of this has been framed in issues of security. And so what does that mean for a lot of communities that see this as a security issue, as a cultural issue? And so it's really about training the trainers, bringing those places to people to places like this, so that they understand that it is theirs and that they can have a stake in it and they can go back and build in their communities. I mean, we brought
construction parties, which is something that Q&A had started doing a couple of years back, and sort of a lot of groups are now doing this, and some of the folks out the West Coast have been doing it for years. Like, this is a way where people can get their hands into the technology and then sort of demystify it. And I think that's vital. When people actually see this, it's like, oh, man.
And it just melts away to, like, they're immediately comfortable with it. Then.
Along those same lines, where are the wireless vendors, for instance, where are they, their stand? Are they more the hand beneath them, or are they more kind of leaning away?
Depends on the it really depends on the vendor. Some of them are really coming on board in a big way, very pro-muni and da-da-da, but they tend to be like, we want municipal wireless networks everywhere using our technology.
Exactly.
You know, so it's like, Tropos is one of those, a bunch of other ones. Like, they're with us just far enough that the technology gets out there because they think that they're going to be the ones selling it.
And I would agree. That's it. Even, like, community-based organizations are now being courted strongly by these proprietary systems because it's segmentation of the market. They see a lot of large fees if at this end of the market that wasn't, you know,
available.
Previously available, weren't seen as marketable, weren't seen as profitable. And so now what they're doing is their point of entry is at the community-based organization level as a way to segment the market and help them bridge the barriers to that market. And so in some ways they are on board, but it's all proprietary. Let me give you, I mean, I'm not going to, well, Cisco system gave out, you know, gave Madison Park, here's 100 wireless cards. Well, what does that really mean if you're training people to work with Cisco systems? You're getting them prepared to only use Cisco systems technology.
We're actually out of time, so I want to give a chance for folks that want to leave to do so, and then maybe, like, we could just meet up right in the front here for folks who still have questions. Thank you very much for coming.
I don't know.
It did it. Did it again?
It did. No.
How you doing? How you doing?
The media justice.
Yeah.
I'm all out of cards, but there is literature at the front desk on the media justice front. You can go to www.fex.org and check us out.
Okay. Would you be interested in possibly doing some pamphlets,
cool.
That are short, easier to read,
including
about community technology? And just, so anyway, I just think that...
We should talk. And you should talk to me particularly because we're about to come out with our toolkits grant that I do for the Media Justice Fund, which is separate from my organizing work that I do with BCT and with other places.
Okay.
So we should talk.
Okay, are you doing some Media Justice?
I am with Tamori. Uh-huh. Tamori is actually one of our grantees, and I'm doing, actually, I'm writing a piece for the, an anthology. Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Our organization has produced a lot of like in-house material that we're working with the community organizations with. So there, if you email me, I can send you what we've developed.
Great, thank you. All right.
Hi. Well, yeah. Well, this is the first time we've met Antoine, but I know Sasha because he's also in Illinois, and we sort of, our organizations found out about each other because we're doing similar, you know, we're trying to solve similar problems, so, and that was about 2 years ago, I'd say. But there was also, Sasha had one of his slides was about the community wireless summit that was last year, and it brought groups from all over the country to Champaign-Urbana in Illinois, and everybody met each other, and we were like, oh, we're all doing the same thing, and it's like 200 groups or something.
So, in there, there's a urine
boundary,
yes. I'm sorry? Well, actually,
it's on information?
PR is a perception. I'm really involved with activists who are
well,
on the ground. Really,
you know, we want our website to become that, but it's not yet. but the QN website is really has a lot of great information.
Organizing social justice, which is
free press.
Well, no, it's a lot more than communication. It's about the economic marginalization. It's about the. It's really about the survival of communities in terms of being able to solve real issues of unemployment, unemployability. Economic marginalization of not being able to have an access to banks and all those other things. So it's a lot more communication.
And in order for you to get your message organized, the people
you're about but mostly in relationship development. Really about securing relationships on the ground with people who are doing work with communities. Which is, I think, a little bit more involved than communication. It's really about, but at some point
well,
we have communicated.
Well, I organize artists, so I'm more talking on issues that are important to them.
Right.
And this is an issue that's important to artists, because it's access.
Right.
You know, I mean, that, to me, that's what we've been cut out. That's why it's popular. I mean, we can't even sell our T-shirts on the streets of Chicago. Some areas are just off bounds, you know.
Right.
Places are just off bounds. Sure, you're free, but you're not free.
Right.
You can't be free. They've got rules that make it difficult or impossible. It looks nice on the surface. They have their way of selling stuff. Anyway, to me, it's the same issue.
So why is it?
Unless people understand
it.
But I mean, it doesn't matter.
It seems complex. We'll give you good service.
Right. Or, and that's the corporation's model.
Right.
I mean,
exactly.
Right. Which is what they tell.
So,
what they tell legislators to say.
For us to get through to the voting public, or the people that are organized.
What? Right. And I think media has to be the second issue, because for a lot of people, it's an economic issue first. It's an employer, unemployment issue first. It's to me, it's a success.
It's a cost. You can't get it in your home for $30 a month, or you can get it for $7.
Right.
You No? Okay, that's an economic issue.
Right, that's an economic issue. And it's, you know, and it should be. And you should, you know, but a lot of the issue is everything now is framed in terms of security, in terms of talked about. Like, you know, do you want people to have access to all your information on your computer if you do it from home? Well, if you use a community wireless network system.
We got a
framework
issue.
Right. Right, but we don't necessarily have the major outlet that they have. You know what they do. What they do is right, and that's what the work that I do with the Media Justice Fund in terms of building relationships. Right.
Exactly. Really, the only point I have.
Right.
Is that we're sort of involved as artists, of course, we're involved grassroots methods like communication.
Good.
All these contents provided on the internet, there's some way to organize some of them, enough of them to frame some of these issues.
Well, a lot of artists have been organized in collaboratives. And so where I can think about in Williamsburg, New York, in Brooklyn, there's a lot of collaboratives there are now seeing this as a major issue, right? And so in terms of...
community.
Right, exactly. In terms of sharing artwork, putting their artwork online, organizing, you know, tours for people who come to New York to come through their spaces, in terms of organizing, using their artists in terms of protest, and many different things. So, yeah. So
these are the benefits of society, members of society that occur when you control the technology.
Exactly.
That comes from the same source.
That's exactly it.
Yeah. So that's why I'm concerned. So I just wanted to, you know, let you receive that flyer on their website, whatever. The issue of bringing artists together
is more emotional. That's exactly it. I forgot, it's me. I'm here. Alrighty. Thanks. Nice meeting you. Cool.
I can get this from you in the van on the way back.
You certainly can.
Huh?
Can we do that? I know, because I'm supposed to be up at 11:30 on Media Justice.
You're here, right?
Yeah.
Oh, you're
staying
here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we're all in the van. We're leaving here shortly, right?
I was going to ask.
Can we do that by 1 o'clock? Can we do it by 1?
Sweet.
Cool.
Okay.
So it's me. It's just me by my lonesome up here, and I got a room. Yeah, it's just me.
You stay put.
Yeah, so I'm going to put something here. So I'm about to put Media Justice and How Do We Get It.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm going to put a little...
We're leaving at 1?
Hopefully, thereabout. Because otherwise, I'm going to get home at 4 o'clock in the morning. And I kind of want to get...
It was great. Absolutely.
Yeah, nice.
I would love to come out and see what you guys are up to. You
sure.
Absolutely come to Chicago.
Sure,
and
I should
have
come to Chicago and talk about it. And I'll put you in contact with the person, Larry, who's actually running that stuff. I do consulting
work. Did I give you my card?
I don't think so.
Yeah, let me give you my card.
I'm so out of it. But I do consulting work in terms of their evaluation and going actually broken the relationship with community and doing the focus groups and the public information session.
Okay.
So they're trying to get communities involved.
We'll be in touch.
That's interesting.
And they come in, and I kind of facilitate walking the community through, hey, this is why we're drilling in your house.
Right.
You know, this is why we're on your roof. This is why we're in your community. And it helps that we're all people of color, actually.
Right.
So it provides us a little entree. But it still takes developing a relationship about, you know, telling some 70-year-old woman that we're going to...
Right, exactly.
Because she needs to use this computer to have...
Well, one of the things we ran into was we were only sort of, like, slightly aware of that issue. So we... So Home and Square was providing, you know, doing the outreach and getting people sort of on board, but we had no idea that, like, they're a lightning rod for all sorts of stuff.
Right.
And so there needed to be, I think, a more neutral, like, facilitation process.
Right. There has to be a facilitation process.
Yeah.
Especially...
And then when we did, there was a lot of anger.
Right. And so it becomes the question, you know, like, when you say working with community organizations, it's about whose community and who says what community is, and how the community sees itself, and who says they speak for the community, and what the direct accountability is. And so I have a process that I go through.
I'll meet you back down here.
Cool. So everybody, we're gonna get started. I was on the panel earlier. I'm gonna run out and run right back. So it's just me. So I'm gonna give you a little music this morning. Yeah. Hit you up with that new comment.
Send me an email, Antoine. Give me your information.
I certainly will do that. We'll talk.
Okay.
What's up? I need to run to the bathroom like crazy. But I'm a.
Do you have audio on that?
All right, I'm hoping.
Yeah. Oh.
Let's see. Mama? Cool. Yeah. But I don't think I'm up. Yeah. I'm wondering. There it is.
Yes, there you go. This also worked.
Good. All right. I'll be right back. Thank you.